it's an emergent area of interest for a lot of people, and I think it's so ingrained in our daily life.
One way you can do that with polytrained athletes is take them to
those tiny babies.
And I guess for every day
like
when I'm working
with patients, we expect a baby to look
It is a topic which is often highly emotive.
Think.
This is Think Help on 2SER 107.3.
Hello, welcome to Think Health, where we cultivate and articulate the best in new health research. I'm Ellen Lee Beter, and you're tuned in to 2SER 107.3. Today on the show, we confront the stereotypes of men in nursing. And you may think that the youth of today are binge-drinking, drug-taking, promiscuous teenagers, but in actual fact, the opposite is true.
We've seen a real decline in the kind of behaviours that cause concern. So drinking, smoking, violence, all of that has declined really for amongst young people.
Also on the program, why patients with heart failure put off going to hospital. But first on the program, there's a common assumption that nursing is a profession for women. Currently, men make up only 10% of nurses in Australia, who are subject to a number of stereotypes from patients, the public, and other medical professionals. On Thursday, the Faculty of Health at the University of Technology Sydney held an event to debunk some of the common misconceptions about male nurses. Lecturer in the Faculty of Health, Caleb Ferguson, led the discussion, with the idea being conceived by two male nursing students at UTS, Jake and Shaq. The three spoke with 2SER's Jake Morecambe ahead of the panel to talk about their experience in nursing and if these stereotypes are slowly loosening.
Well, at the beginning, we didn't expect to get into nursing. I think that's the major thing. And we want people to be aware of it from the beginning so that they don't need to go through what we went through and change from another course.
But a lot of, you know, men, I guess, don't really see nursing as a career for them during high school because, you know, it's always been talked about as a woman's job. But really, it's anyone can do it.
And there's stereotypes, which are a number of them, which surround men in the nursing work environment. The point of the event is to try and debunk some of those stereotypes. In your experience, and Caleb too, what are some of the stereotypes that surround men in nursing?
Yeah, I guess that some of the main stereotypes for me are around about some of the feminine values of nursing, particularly, and viewing men that undertake nursing, looking at them as being quite feminine. I guess that caring, as Jake's kind of highlighted, is one of the essential components of nursing, and I think to be a successful nurse, you really need to care about your patients. And so I think people being in touch and men being in touch with their emotions, I guess, and showing a bit of empathy towards another human might be viewed as quite a feminine thing to do in society today. So I think that the event kind of will debunk quite a few of those myths, hopefully.
And another one, it's kind of in the past seems as though females have fallen into the nursing profession and it's more so been men who've strived to become doctors or earn that so-called higher order position. Is that still the case today?
No, like in practice you'll see, I think that the latest statistics show around about 10% of the workforce are men in nursing. However, you look around some of the clinical areas today, the key areas that men particularly work in nursing tend to be more critical care areas, so the emergency department, the ICU, mental health and primary health care. But you have a look at some of the clinical areas and now more and more of the younger medical workforce are becoming females as well. So it's quite typical these days to have a male nurse and to have a female doctor as well. So I think it's been kind of thought particularly it might be some of the more technical areas that draws men into. And I guess through our event, we often find that some of the students that come through are really interested in, say, the simulation that we do at UTS because it's quite technical and quite hands-on, and I guess that this is probably reinforcing the stereotype that guys like to play with kind of, you know, games and toys and that sort of thing. So I think that some of the higher, more technical areas draws guys to undertake work in those areas.
Well, Jake and Shaq, there's a multifaceted field of nursing. Is there anywhere in particular that you guys are interested in or you're interested in kind of pursuing down the long run?
I guess palliative care. For now, that's just what I have on my mind. But it could change because we have clinical practice and we can just have a go at every single different segment of nursing. And then you can have your like final decision at the end. So it's pretty cool.
Probably emergency medicine or something like that, because I find that stuff so interesting. And you're involved with the patient from the get-go as soon as they enter the hospital. And you can really, I don't know, go along the journey with them until they get to the wards. And yeah, as Caleb said, I mean, surgical, ICU, emergency, it just attracts a lot of males.
Have you had any experience of these stereotypical reactions to being a male nurse, like even from patients or other people in the hospital?
I guess you could have patients, you know, ask for a female nurse because they're just more comfortable with a female nurse. But most of the patients don't mind as long as you're confident about it.
Yeah, I found the same thing as Shaq. Patients don't really care that we're males generally. If I was in hospital, I would have expected it would be a female in the past. But now, these days, I mean, it could be male or female, it doesn't matter, really. But obviously, stereotypically, the reactions. I have got some from older nurses who have, you know, been working for years and years and just don't believe that males should be nurses. I have got a few reactions like that. But just besides that, not really as much as I thought, to be honest.
In your time working in the nursing profession, what have you come across, Caleb, in the world of stereotype?
I guess it's funny. I'm thinking about my training, which I undertook in Scotland as well at a university there. It's funny, I always remember on my clinical placement, the first encounter with someone being a bit, not anti-male, but preferring a female assistant with their shower. And so it was like they were saying to me, oh, son, I don't want you to shower me. you know, can I have a woman? And I guess it's about how you face that and how you communicate with your patients around about preferences. Often when we see patients in the acute care setting, they're often very sick and very vulnerable and really value the support that they get from nursing staff. And I think that at that time of need, people do have preferences, and that's perfectly okay. But I think it's how you approach that situation and deal with it as well. And I think more and more in contemporary nursing society, there is an increase in males in the workforce, and it's about how that's communicated with the general public as well in terms of the care that they will receive in hospital. Touching upon something though, if we think about patients generally go to the hospital as well and will be seen by a doctor, and often people won't have a preference for doctors or, you know, some of the potentially more invasive procedures, you might have gender preferences if you're undergoing something that's a bit more intimate in terms of a procedure.
Just one question I want to pose, this is as a very general one. Are there major differences between male and female nurses in 2015?
No.
I don't think there is. No, there isn't.
No.
I really try to think about that one, but no.
Yeah.
There really isn't.
We tried to discuss this the other day, but no, there's no difference.
Yeah. And why do you think there isn't a difference?
Because the quality of care doesn't matter what, you know.
As long as you care for the patient, I mean, that's all that matters at the end of the day. If you've got that caring attitude and...
Yeah, a guy can just be just as caring as, you know, a woman, so it's not...
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think there's anything to it.
And Caleb was saying, I guess for some young men who are in high school or just going into university and they haven't really thought about nursing being a profession, when you were doing medical science or even before that, did you have any view, like how has your view of what nursing is as student nurses changed?
To put it simply, I feel like we kind of underestimated nursing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Basically we just underestimated it. We didn't really think about it. And at the time we thought, you know, medical science sounds cool, but once you go through the course, you realize that, and you find out about nursing and you actually explore it, you go, well, this is pretty good. It's actually really practical. It's useful.
I agree. As I said before, I never thought I'd be doing nursing in high school because I always thought, you know, it was a woman's job, you know, stereotypes and stuff. But once you get to university, you realize that in any career, any job, I mean, anyone can do it. It doesn't matter about your gender. I mean, nursing's great. There's lots of fields to explore. And I mean, that's how we got clinical placements to explore what areas we're most interested in.
Caleb, you did research a couple of years back about men in nursing on television and how in certain programs they're portrayed to be in a certain way.
Yeah, we undertook, it was actually with some colleagues from University of Western Sydney in 2012, 2013. And we looked at a number of variety of fictional dramas on television that had male nurse characters. So Nurse Jackie and Private Practice and so on. Obviously, TV informs a lot of potential students or young people's career choices somewhat. And so it's important that there's an accurate representation of men in nursing through those dramas, because it does help shape and inform people's opinions of different professions. And we found that it really implicitly reinforced the stereotypes that you think of male nurses, and so that being med school dropout, doctor's handmaiden, the sort of feminine homosexual type character, or the prop minority character, and also as a bit of humour to add into it. So there wasn't much of an accurate portrayal really in those series that we looked at, and there was real need to sort of develop an accurate portrayal in the media of what it is that men in nursing do, that they're a skilled profession and that they're equal to their female counterparts. So I think that wasn't great for the profession in terms of how these characters are portrayed in these series, and that there's need really to sort of raise awareness that we are skilled, highly skilled healthcare professionals, and that, you know, we are equal as our counterparts, our female counterparts.
So a question for Jake and Shaq. What is the thing that you want most to come out of the event?
Well, especially for high school leavers, that there is
awareness.
Yeah.
I think awareness is important. I want them to know about it, you know, explore
it.
That
it is a job that you can do, and that you don't have to be a female to go into it.
I want them to consider it. Like, if you consider it, then half the job's done. Because then you go and think about it. We didn't consider it before. That's the only reason why we didn't do it earlier. But once you get to consider it, then you find out. It's pretty cool.
I mean, if you care for people and considering nursing as a job, just go for it, because it is a fantastic job that will come at the end of it. You'll always be helping people, and you don't have to be female to do it.
Caleb Ferguson and two nursing students from UTS, Jake and Shaq, ending that discussion by Jake Morecambe. Coming up next, how the youth of today may not be as wild as you think.
Bendigo Bank is different. It's a community bank, owned and staffed by locals, with profits staying in the community. Bendigo Bank invests profits to support community projects every day, from local schools, sporting groups, parks, medical centres, surf clubs, SES units, and other services that have an impact on our everyday lives. So when you bank with Bendigo Bank, your banking will also directly benefit your community. More info at bendigobank.com.au. Bigger than a bank, Bendigo Bank sponsors 2SER 107.3.
Thanks very much for renewing or becoming a financial supporter of 2SCR during our recent supporter drive. Every dollar goes towards coming up with more great stories, ideas and music for you. If you'd still like to support 2SCR, you can. Go online to 2scr.com or call us on 9514 9514. 2SCR 107.3. We can't do what we do without you.
Welcome back to Think Health on 2SER. Now, the youth of today often get a bad rap. They're into drugs, they're promiscuous, they smoke, and they drink too much alcohol. But is the risk-taking behaviour as bad as adults think? The Health Behaviour in School-Aged Children, or HBSC, is a study that is undertaken in 43 countries across the world. The study looks at the health and well-being of adolescents aged 11, 13 and 15. Interestingly, across the world, risk-taking behaviour among adolescents is on the decline, but stress and anxiety is increasing, especially among girls. Fiona Brooks is a Professor of Child and Adolescent Health at UTS. She has been involved in the HBSC study in England and joined me earlier to discuss some of the findings.
It's a World Health Organization supported study. And we currently do it in 43 countries across the world, and it's been going since 1982 and repeated every 4 years. So we've really got good decades now of really good data around young people's health and well-being. We ask young people about every aspect of their life. So we don't just ask about the traditional things that people are concerned about in adolescence, such as drinking, drugs, smoking, you know, the sex and rock and roll kind of issues. We actually talk to young people about what they think about their school life, their family, their friends, their positive health behaviours as well. So we've got some really good data on what really makes young people tick.
What countries are involved in the study?
Right, so primarily it's been Europe and North America, but now we've got linked projects which are piloting the study in Taiwan, China and Australia.
So this looks at 11, 13 and 15-year-olds?
Yes, yeah.
Why this age group?
Because at age 11, for example, we see boys and girls and pretty much being the same. So they have good well-being, good body image. They're just starting high school. And things are pretty generally reported to be pretty okay for them. It's during that 11, 13 and 15-year-old kind of age that we really see a change. Young people go through puberty, they start to become more independent, and it's this age that, if successfully navigated, has all sorts of positive outcomes for the rest of their life. So it's a really important phase. And also now, we now know that brain development in the second decade of life continues and is doing some really important things for young people's brains that really, you know, need to be shaped and are shaped by the environment that they're in. So all the kind of synaptic pruning and protection that takes place of the synapses in the brain really happens during this period, and it really and is dependent on a positive environment. So if young people are in toxic environments, then it really affects their brain damage, their brain development permanently.
Over the last couple of years, what have been some of the trends that you've found?
Right, well, across the last decade, it's been really interesting because we've seen, contrary to many people's popular views around young people and a lot of the negative kind of press, we've seen a real decline in the kind of behaviours that cause concern. So drinking, smoking, violence, all of that has declined really for amongst young people. But at the same time, we're seeing emotional well-being also decline, and particularly amongst teenage girls. I think there's a real concern around the rise in just levels of anxiety, stress, and behaviours such as self-harm have really dramatically increased. So, for example, in the England survey we completed, 33% of 15-year-old girls reported that they had ever self-harmed, which I think is a shocking statistic and something we need to be seriously doing something about.
With that emotional well-being, I think I was reading in the English study that those 11-year-old girls and boys, there wasn't really much difference in stress levels and all the rest of it. But it was by the time of 15 that there was a really noticeable difference between girls and boys. What do you put that down to?
Well, to be honest, we don't know. At this precise moment, we need much more research and exploration of the data to actually identify the differences, because, interestingly enough, very few studies look at gender differences in this age group. But one of the key things is the pressures girls report, certainly around things like body image, the pressures they feel to conform to gendered expectations around what a girl should be. And I think those kinds of pressures have actually increased across the last decade. And we're now seeing those kind of pressures being experienced by boys as well. The pressure to look good all the time, to kind of be popular, all of that, and as well to achieve in school. School standards have increased. The pressures in schools have also increased for young people. So we need to be providing better support, really.
It's interesting that the pressures have increased on young people, but you'd think they'd turn to, what do adults do? They turn to drugs and alcohol to self-medicate.
Yes, in many ways our young people are setting much better examples. Certainly policy's made a difference. It's much harder, for example, in the UK, and I believe here, to kind of, you know, drink ahead of the legal age. There's much more regulation around that. Young people are in much more supervised activities. So, and also it's become less acceptable amongst young people. When we reported to them, they understand that their futures are on the line at this age group, during this age, and they really do understand they need to achieve well at school. So in many ways, they're setting really good examples.
And surely education comes into that as well.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the sort of support that's provided by schools is critical. A lot of our data has shown that really good health education in schools makes a fundamental difference to, and for example, in schools where, in the UK, where there is really good support and health education and personal development support, we find levels of self-harm and anxiety to be much lower. So schools really can play a critical role in addressing that. And parents, believe it or not, which may be hard for any parent who's listening at the moment, you know, when they're dealing with a door-slamming adolescent. But actually, we find that parents who keep an open door and good communication with their young people, actually, their young people can navigate adolescence much more successfully.
15 is still quite a young age, I think, yes, to undertake those risk-taking behaviours. Do you think that it would change if you were looking at 17-year-olds?
Yes, that's a really good question. Actually, what we'd really like to do is start looking at older adolescents, so the 18 to 24-year group, so the university students sort of age group, because they're the ones who are really experiencing pressures in terms of the workforce. And we believe that actually some of the risk behaviours might have shifted just into that older group. And there's a real concern about emotional well-being and anxiety in that age group as well. So we know, for example, that young male suicides are on the increase. So we do need to be thinking about the whole gamut of adolescents and young people and their well-being.
And can you tell me a little bit about Australia? We've recently done a pilot study similar to this.
So, yes, Australia is seeing the same kind of trends, really. Your physical activity levels aren't as high as I would have thought they would have been, actually. Your risk behaviours, though, are also lower. So that's a positive. But your self-harm and issues and emotional well-being is also not as good as it should be. So we are seeing kind of global trends here.
So where do you think that... do you think that things like self-harm are going to continue to increase globally?
Well, I think if we can put in place and listen to these early findings, we can kind of stem the tide and really, you know, address that kind of potential iceberg that we're going to be facing. And really think about how we can put in good support around schools. You know, we've had a decade of drugs education, alcohol education, smoking education. Now we need to switch and really understand where this generation of young people are coming from and the anxiety and stress that they're under.
Fiona Brooks, Professor of Child and Adolescent Health at UTS. Coming up next, why people with heart failure avoid going to the emergency department here on Think Health.
Returning to study can be a big decision. UTS Postgrad Info Session course leaders can help you make the right choices. Considering a career move or further developing your skill set? Talk to a course leader and get the knowledge you need to take ownership of your future. More info at postgraduate.uts.edu.au. Own the knowledge, own your future. UTS sponsors 2SER 107.3.
Activate Fit on Harris at UTS is your gym in the heart of Ultimo.
With classes all day in yoga, Pilates, spin, boxing, suspension, body pump and more, Activate Fit is perfect for an early morning class or a workout during lunch.
Sign up or renew your membership at Activate Fit on Harris today.
Activate Fit on Harris, 733 Harris Street, Ultimo, or head to activatefit.com.au.
Activate Fit on Harris sponsors 2SER 107.3.
You're listening to Think Health on 2SER 107.3.
Welcome back to Think Health on 2SER. Have you ever put off seeing your doctor or going to the hospital because you were worried about crying wolf? Well, this is the reality for patients with heart failure, a blanket term to describe a range of heart problems that end up causing heart failure. Patients will experience breathlessness and fatigue in their day-to-day life, but it's when symptoms such as these worsen that help is needed. However, many patients with heart failure will wait until symptoms get severe before they seek help. This has flow-on effects about the care provided and the length of stay in hospital. Sarah Ivinian is a PhD student in the Faculty of Health at UTS. She is looking into the reasons why patients with heart failure go to hospital at the last minute.
Well, life with heart failure is really quite restricted, particularly for those patients who are suffering with multiple symptoms, and this is on a daily basis. So in terms of carrying out their daily routine, you know, going to the shops, even getting out of bed, drawing the curtains, that kind of thing is really quite a struggle because they're constantly feeling breathless and fatigued, and they often have to rest and accommodate their routine to their symptoms.
What causes heart failure?
So heart failure is kind of like the end stage of heart disease. So the number one cause is a previous heart attack. And sort of there's a whole range of other cardiovascular diseases that sort of end up in heart failure.
So people with heart failure experience these symptoms, and often these symptoms can get worse.
Yes.
What happens when they get worse? Do people go to hospital?
Well, yes. The number one reason why people with heart failure are hospitalized is for their symptoms. So the number one cause of heart failure hospitalization is breathlessness. So they'll be feeling really breathless and have this really acute symptom exacerbation. And that's really quite frightening because they're often gasping for air. And, you know, I've read that patients describe this as not knowing if the next breath is going to be their last. It's really quite frightening. And this is often the driver of these hospitalizations.
So you've been looking into when patients with heart failure go to hospital.
Yes.
At what point do they make that decision?
Well, the big problem is that up to 50% of these people actually put off seeking care until their symptoms become that severe. So they're not actually seeking timely care, which kind of has some really not so great implications for them.
So as soon as it gets worse, basically it would be ideal for them to go to the hospital.
Well, or even just call for help, or just call their doctor or whoever and say, you know, I'm experiencing these symptoms, what should I do? But
what happens when the symptoms are severe and they end up in hospital?
Well, the hospitalization in itself is not necessarily the most pleasant experience for a lot of these people. And then once they've been hospitalized, their chances of being re-hospitalized actually increases. And if they're in hospital, if they go to hospital at that point where their symptoms are so severe, treatment is often actually quite complicated and they end up staying in hospital for a lot longer. And also their chances of survival is decreased as well. So it's really better to get in early.
You've been looking at why people delay going to hospital. What are some of those reasons?
Oh, well, this is really quite a complicated decision-making process, and there's a whole range of factors why some patients put it off. So sometimes they don't actually link their symptoms with heart failure or a heart problem in general. For example, breathlessness. A lot of people wouldn't necessarily straight away be able to link that with a heart problem. I mean, people expect to feel chest pain and that sort of thing. So when they're feeling breathless, they kind of, you know, particularly if they have asthma or another sort of respiratory disorder, it's really hard to actually identify where that symptom is coming from. So they kind of put it off and they think, you know, oh, it's okay, or it's not that severe. They think it's going to get better. They wait and see. That's really common.
I noticed in your literature review that this was particularly prevalent in rural patients.
Yes. So that was really interesting. I found that in that sort of cultural context, attitudes towards seeking care was really quite different. So these people had grown up, you know, sort of living a tough life. Like they've always had to work hard and sort of push through and endure any sort of physical, you know, because their work was quite physical, so they sort of had to endure anything, any sort of physical thing they were feeling. And they sort of had the same attitude towards symptoms and they just pushed through them. So that was really interesting in that rural group of people.
What role do carers play in all this?
So carers play quite an important role, actually, because they often help these patients actually make the decision whether or not it's time to seek care. So a lot of the time patients will feel like they're just complaining and they feel like it's not a valid enough reason to call for help. But when someone else comes in and says, okay, I think we should go to the hospital, or I think you should call the doctor, that kind of validates their concerns. And so that's really important. And also that they are often the ones to drive them to hospital or to call the ambulance. So they play really quite an important role.
If you'd like to find out more about that story or listen to any of our past programs, head to our website at 2ser.com/thinkhealth. This show is produced with the support of the University of Technology Sydney Faculty of Health. Please remember that you should not consider the contents of this show medical advice, and you should consult your physician if you have any concerns. I'm Ellen Leadbeater. This has been Think Health. See you next week for more in health research and news.